Hey, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. All right, I have not gone crazy, although if I hear that song one more time, I might be going crazy in this pandemic. But today on Breaking Banks, we're going to be talking with Mary-Kate Loftus, Senior Vice President and Director of Digital at M&T Bank, and we're going to be talking about happiness. Now, the first time Mary-Kate and I started this conversation, it was relatively easy to be happy because we were actually at MX's FinTech Summit up at Sundance, staring at the mountains and the snow, and everything was good. No one was locked down, spending all this quality time. No one was doing homeschooling. But one of the things, Mary-Kate, that you know, for being a, apologies for saying this, you're a digital nerd, which is part of why I like you, but you were so happy about being a banker. And that was, it was actually infectious in that level of how excited you are to be a banker. So maybe to start, why do you love being a banker so much?
I love being a banker. You're right. I think it is like just an awesome, delightful career. I think it's because bankers are helping people with one of the most important aspects of their life, which is how to manage their money and how to, you know, achieve their dreams.
Has that changed at all? Right now in the middle of, you know, a pandemic, we've got a crisis, we've got, you know, people who are stressed, you know, has that sense of meaning changed right now? I'm assuming it's gone up, right? I don't mean to be leading the witness, but how would you characterize the way it's changed?
I mean, I think gone up would be an understatement. I've seen executives so moved by what is going on, like literally brought to tears. I think there's such meaning in how we're able to help customers, whether it's keeping the lights on and the doors open and people receiving a paycheck, or helping customers that have lost their jobs, or in the other way, saying, how do I protect myself now? I want to make sure I have a good plan in place. So it's actually brought back even more meaning of the impact we have on people's lives.
Now, with your digital hat on, the digital world is often, you know, accused or painted with the strokes of, oh, it's taking the human out of this and the importance of the relationship. How do you reconcile that, you know, part of your job is to put a screen in front of that customer, not another human?
I think that's a great question. I think that's often how people might perceive it at first, and that's completely not what it is when it's done right. And I believe, especially for regional banks like M&T, it is about your presence in the community, the relationship. And what digital does is digital accelerates and simplifies your life. It helps you get the information you need quickly. It puts everything at your fingertips. It might give you solutions that you're almost afraid to talk to someone at the bank about yet. And then you get that confidence, you get the information you need. And I believe that, you know, we see in the data that even for digital originations, our most accounts that actually turn into relationships are often the ones that have a person involved in them too.
Oh, interesting. How are you measuring that? Like, how do you get that crossover? That sounds hard.
Yeah, how we can measure it is you look at, when you look at the originations, and then you're able to see, you follow the contact through, and you're able to see, did the person have an appointment with somebody? We actually use ClickFox. So ClickFox tells us that journey mapping that you're able to see when, you know, trace back who talked to the customer, and then you can pull the analytics behind it to get the measures on the relationships that turn profitable. So what we've been doing lately, it's interesting, is now with branches having more capacity because there's less people walking in, we've ramped up our digital onboarding. So accounts that are open online, having bankers call them and say, hi, I'm here, how can I help you? And the customers love it.
Wow. You know, a call from your bank that isn't the, I'm either trying to sell you something else or, heaven forbid, you know, you're late with something. It's the, I'm here to help aspect.
That's right.
What other tools have you leaned into now that, you know, we're in a world and who knows if this is the new normal, you know, forever, that you say, you know, these are the new digital tools when it comes to expanding and extending our relationship and our capabilities? What other sorts of things are you looking at or have you deployed?
Yeah, I think, I mean, we're looking like every bank, I'm sure, we're looking at how we take what was already on the digital agenda and accelerating it. So we're looking at what fintechs really could be great partners for us. So the picture on one side of the spectrum is the looking ahead and what we want to be able to create and what experiences we want to bring. Right now, here and in the present, you look at the tools that are out there. And a good example is what we recently did with MS. So we already had Money Smart out there, which helps with aggregation and budgeting. And we had a debt payoff calculator. And we saw customers as this started logging in more frequently. We were seeing an increase of about 20% in the activity, which is significant. And then we worked with MX and we brought a little ahead of schedule their cash flow feature out. And that allows customers to be able to predict what their balances will be based upon recurring automatic debits and credits that hit the account. And so that's an example of something that we brought ahead and we said, let's make sure our customers can have access now. A second example would be we work with EverFi as well for Money Mentor, we call it. So Money Mentor is even to people that are non-customers. So you can go out on mtb.com and right from our Be Aware, which is the COVID pandemic pages, click on the link and you can go through all the information out there. So people who need advice or just don't know what to do, they're able to get that.
What are you hearing from customers in response to this? Are you getting any feedback on this already?
On the on cash flow, yes. So what we're doing, we're actually starting. We launched it, and now we have survey features. So we're using Adobe Analytics to be able to track and see where they're clicking, what they're doing. But then also we popped up surveys to say, why did you click here? What exactly are you looking for? And I think as we start that, then we'll go deeper and through. We'll probably use focus groups and a little bit of ethnographic research and dive in and understand what they're actually doing to get that feedback. It's very early. It just launched a week and a half ago, so we're just getting started. There.
Impressive statistics nonetheless. And I'm curious when it comes to your team and the things you're doing, how are you actually, managing the happiness of your team, right now and the roles they have as they're dealing with their own stresses?
That is a great question. It has been unlike anything I've ever gone through in my life. And I'm sure like anybody that's listening is in the same boat. We were lucky that we had, MNT is a very much person to person, you're in the office, you're working in your agile scrum teams, like people walking the floors sort of environment. And back in January, or actually it was December, we launched Microsoft Teams and everyone started using Teams pretty religiously. And so we had the tools in place. We had Miro, but we probably didn't use it as like often as we are today. And we have other tools like Trello, and of course we got Jira and the Atlassian suite and all of that. But we very quickly people were able to adjust, and from a ways of working, we got everyone together, everyone had the tools, and people loved it. The keys to success, I think, are the leveraging video. So it's when you're working from home, making sure everybody's turning that video on. And then amazingly, people got comfortable with it really fast. And secondly, I think, is regular touch points. When you think about, like, you're asking about how you engage people so they're happy and they feel part of everything, even when you're remote and working from home, is we were doing daily touch points on video. Then we went to 3 times a week, and now we're down to twice a week. And we have everybody dial in, and we talk, we give status updates, communicate transparently, and then people have what they need, this foundation, so that they can go do their work.
Yeah, I wonder if this is not going to be the tipping point finally for collaboration, that CISOs can no longer say no to Slack and to Teams, and this idea of collaboration does not mean everyone needs to be around the same conference room table.
I think you're right. And I think it's one of these things where you have to do it to learn it and believe it. And probably the right answer is a balance, in the middle. It's about human, just like banking, right? It's about human to human, relationships and trust. But you can do that remote. You can do that online.
Yeah. How many cat memes are getting passed around related to...
Well, it's good. Like at our group, we have an employee engagement committee, and so they're able to do the fun things, So there's a lot of mocktails and cocktail recipes and things like that going around too. So,
and it's funny. It's a good time. At Perk Street, we were early adopters of Yammer, which was purchased by Microsoft, which became part of Teams. And I had mandated, because the whole idea was we had people working at various hours and remotely, even before that became a super popular thing. Keep in mind, this is 2010 that we had rolled it out. And no one was using it for the virtual stand-up. We were trying to do asynchronous stand-up, right? It was this beautiful idea. People could be where they wanted, do what they wanted. Would you believe the first thing that took off, and the only thing that took off, was people posting cat memes? Someone had created a channel called Cat Memes. And I was like furious. But interestingly enough, that became the thing that got people going to it repeatedly. Like that was the behavioral change that needed to tip, that only after a week of people doing nothing but cat memes to tick me off. And yes, for our senior producer, our audio team, I did resist swearing so it didn't have to be edited out, but I was furious, right? Cat memes. But it changed the behavior that they got used to using it. I'm curious. Yeah.
You got to have fun at work. I mean, I think that's a big part of it. And just because you're not face-to-face sitting next to each other doesn't mean you're not going to have fun anymore. And I think people, that's part of creating an engaged workforce and happy culture.
So what else have you found that behaviors have changed within, let's start within the bank. Let's go back to the customers in terms of behavioral change. What else have you seen, you know, that this has brought about, you know, either positive or negative in terms of behavior change?
We definitely saw we'll call the slow adopters to digital becoming opening their mind and saying, I think I need to figure this out. So I always think of digital activity from a customer perspective in three buckets. So the first being, are they enrolled? The second being, are they active? And the third being, are they engaged? So we did start to see, and it ramped up right through that first direct deposits that hit for the CARES Act. And it really just built and built and built. And then we saw people signing up. We saw them logging in to check their balance. Yeah, it's too early to say it's a sustained behavior change, but we are seeing people that had not used digital channels before using digital channels to do, you know, mobile check deposits, transfers, bill pay. Zelle's been a big one. A lot of Zelle activity. We've seen an increase in that as well.
I'm curious, we've heard this from several banks that increased Zelle activity. What are they replacing with Zelle activity? Like, were they handing cash to people? Like, are we talking business Zelle or are we talking consumer Zelle? What are people doing differently, right? It's coming from somewhere.
I think it is it's consumer Zelle. And what they are doing is moving money to their friends. They're actually, I feel like now that they've logged in, they didn't really realize that tool was there available to them. And now they're taking advantage of it.
Oh, interesting. Now, do you think these behaviors are going to stick for the long term? And one of the things, you know, we look at is Instacart just had a huge number of signups in the over 60 crowd, right? They'd had some press around that. And I think it'll be interesting to say, hey, if you're over 60 and you've now realized groceries, you know, can come to your doorstep for a small incremental amount, you know, is that behavior change going to stick? How are you thinking about it as M&T in terms of behavior change? And, you know, what does digital begin to look like within the scope of your consumer's life?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. You think about the breadth of customers whose needs we meet. So it's everything from people that are just entering the banking system, you know, right through every life stage, through our wisest customers, I'll call them, right? So what, everyone has different needs. I do believe, you know, the early indication that people are starting, once they've learned how to log in, learn how to do the mobile app, they do become comfortable. Tying it back to your question about person to person and digital, for many people who did not trust using, you know, digital means to move their money or to manage their accounts, once they had a walkthrough, whether it's through a branch banker, our contact center, our digital teams in the contact center had very extended hold times because they were walking people through what to do. Once they felt comfortable, I believe some of those basic transactions they'll continue to do. You know, what we're hearing from our customers is that as the branches are, you know, opened up again, as they feel safe, that's a big part of that, that they love the relationship with their community bankers, the ones that especially look to them for advice and guidance. They want that validation of a decision. So I believe that they will start to get information online, validate it with a person that they trust, and that a lot of simple transactions will go digital, more complex for those customers that are moving along and evolving their behaviors will still continue to do person to person.
Well, and that brings us full circle to, you know, the happiness theme again. How do you tie back with these new behaviors, this happiness loop? And I guess maybe one of the foundational questions, how important is it, do you think, that bankers are happy, you know, in the job of being a banker, right? You know, it's different than, you know, some other things you don't often think of. If you were to say, you know, rate, who do you think is the happiest person? You know, probably bartenders and baristas are always at the top and bankers, you know, probably not in the top five. You know, but how important
is it? Yeah. I think what it is that it's if, and I've read some books, you probably have too, about what happiness really is. And it's about when you feel that you have purpose and meaning, right? When you're engaged, you feel like you're part of something, you belong. And what's happened recently, and you think about what happened with PPP, we used digital capabilities to take the applications in, right? Then you had, and I can tell you a little bit about that if you want to hear about it, but then you had, it was backed up with 2,000 employees who like had to actually assist helping customers, making sure the documentation was good, reviewing applications for credit quality. And what that did was when they heard back from that customer who they were able to keep the doors open and said, wow, you've changed my life. Thank you for helping me get through this. That gave meaning. That created, I believe, a bond that will not be broken. And when you have that, you feel happy. You say, I can't wait to come in. And I think that's why you probably heard it from every bank, people that were working exceptionally long hours, sacrificing their personal time because they believed in what they were doing. And I think that that will continue. I think it's renewed the industry. And I think that this new connection where, especially going into the next 12 to 18 months, it brings an the importance of banks to be able to help the people in the community rises. And it just gives everyone a real deep meaning. And when you have meaning, you're happy. So I think it's actually a very important turning point in our industry, I think.
Yeah, I agree with you. Circa 2008, there was some research done around public perception of various jobs. And it turns out that bankers rated below used car salespeople in terms of perception, in terms of public trust. And I think, we're at a turning point for that to change. And I also think, back to your theme of the digital extends it, not replaces it, that's going to become more important. So when was the last time you had like true surprise and delight when it came to a digital feature? And not one that you put out where you're like, I was surprised and delighted because I'm the one who got it done. But what does it take? First give us an example. Let's talk about what it takes to bring surprise and delight into a feature.
I mean, I think about it could be as easy as a servicing function that, how a lot of times, like, let's say you have something you have to do. And oh gosh, this process could be painful and I'm going to have to go to the bank. And an example would be, we're doing a lot of work now with DocuSign and there's teams that are saying, all right, if the branches are closed, we can't come in. We used to do it this way. What's the most efficient way to do it? And although those don't seem like, they're not going to, have a headline and, those are real customers. Those are meaningful. But in terms of real surprise and delight, I think about, at the beginning, I was telling you about goals and how for a customer, the purpose that we serve is we help customers achieve their goals. And when it's setting, for example, say if you say, when all this pandemic's over, I'm going on a trip and I want to set aside that $5,000, I need to be able to do it. And when we're able to help them do that, that is meaningful. Like that helps somebody do something that they weren't able to otherwise do. So I think that's important. One last thing I do have to say from a business banking perspective, everything that just happened right now with the last few weeks, surprise and delight was when people are worried and they're saying, can I actually get this money? I know people are relying upon me to get it. And when their banker's calling them at, 11 o'clock at night saying, I need one more thing. We got this in. It's all set. Don't worry. We got you. Like, again, that is real impact on people's lives. I think that is surprise and delight.
Yeah,
and that's meaningful.
Oh, and that definitely, imbues meaning, and the idea of, you mentioned MX and the cash flow predictor, that brings real meaning, especially now. Do you have other either internal tech or partnerships you've done with fintech providers that kind of lean into that idea of either goals or some of the other themes you said that give meaning?
Well, it's interesting. I can't share their specific capabilities and things we're doing. What we are working on is, and I think you and I had talked about this back in February, was that we start everything by the customer. So we have segments of customers and customers that we deeply focus on. And what we're doing is we've started the work, luckily, back months and months ago, to listen to them, to observe them in their homes, observe them when they're at work and say, how are you using these banking tools? And from there, we're able to say, this is the unmet need. This is the need that nobody is filling right now. And this might even be something that the customer isn't even asking us for, but this is something M&T can give them that they never expected. So what we're doing from two fronts is we've got our teams that are working on what does that look like? What can that look like? We've got our technology and digital team saying, if we know we will want to create and deliver these experiences in the financial ecosystem of the customer, how do we get ready? And that's when we have the right platforms in place. That's when we were ready to deal with APIs, because we want to be, in some cases, co-creating with fintech, co-creating with people that live and breathe these experiences to be able to bring them to life for our customers. So although I can't share anything to say this is it, I can tell you that there is an awful lot that we're working on and we're hoping to be able to bring to market not too long.
Well, and it's great to hear because it's the one place I think the fintech startups had a huge advantage was starting with a clean slate, which the clean slate also means I have no customers, no one paying me, and no existing business. They had to go figure out really quickly what their customers had as an unmet need. And our customers do a horrible job of telling us that. But if you have an existing business, right, like people are opening checking accounts or, you know, taking loans and doing those things, it's really hard to say, well, clearly something is working because they're doing it. Let's go find some other, you know, level of surprise and delight. Culturally, was that hard to imbue, this idea of we've got to get out of the branch, we got, you know, out of our four walls and get out, we have to listen to them, it's not we know best?
It actually, people were so hungry to do it. So this has been going on now for, I'd say, about 2.5 years at the bank. And the way that we approach it is saying there's people, we have to run our businesses and we have to do it, you know, very well, but we also have to get out and we have to be untethered. We have to talk to other people in the industry and see what's going on. We have to talk to other partners and imagine, and we have to, most importantly, be out with our customers and out in our markets. So people love it. It energizes them. And that, tying it back to your happy comment and how do you create a happy workforce and engage bankers that love what they're doing, that's how you do it. You allow people to not have to work, you know, according to, I'll say, bank orthodoxy. And instead, you're able to imagine what's possible that re-energizes people and helps them do the best work of their lives. So there's a lot of cool stuff like that that's going on.
All right. Last question before we go to break. What's the last thing you did that made you happy?
Oh, easy. I was outside visiting with my kids at lunchtime because I'm working from home and I get to see them every day during the day.
Oh, fantastic. So time for a short break right now. When we come back, talking to a community banker that is an online-only bank that also develops deep relationships with a very specific segment, and his deep expertise coming actually out of one of the more interesting places, Hurricane Katrina, and what it meant to be serving customers in an environment like that. Thank you very much, Mary-Kate, for joining us from M&T Bank, and look forward to hearing many more happy things from you.
Oh, thanks, Jason. I had a great time.
Jack Henry is a great supporter of Breaking Banks. Jack Henry Digital is the pioneer and creator of personal digital banking that helps community financial institutions translate their trust and live local personal service meaningfully into digital channels. Jack Henry Digital also helps community financial institutions strategically differentiate their digital offerings from those of the mega banks and the big tech and fintechs. How do they do it? Well, it's with their Banno digital platform, a complete 100% API-enabled open digital banking platform. You get lightning-fast native apps, integrated PFM, you get cloud-based core-connected back-office tools for employees, and with the website marketing and content management capabilities built into their community, you can launch, track, and target campaigns quickly from click-through to product acquisition. Don't forget to also check out Banno Conversations, a first-of-its-kind, fully authenticated, secure chat capability that enables branch staff to connect digitally with customers. You want to check it out? You really have to see this in action. Visit banno.com to schedule a demo today. That's banno.com.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. Have Kurt Kiros, the CEO of Cab Bank. I've been fortunate to know Kurt for a very long time. They're one of our founding banks at Alloy Labs Alliance. We also have spoken at many industry events together. And, you know, one thing I do know is Kurt is very passionate about what he does. Now, it doesn't, you know, come across, he's a pretty mellow guy, not going to get your face on it, but he loves being a banker. So I'm curious, how did you end up becoming a banker?
Hello, Jason. Yeah, I am passionate about it. I'll agree. I'll admit that. So I ended up becoming a banker because actually my dad was a banker and he was a president of a small bank, 60 million in assets in New Orleans, where I grew up. And I ended up becoming a banker because when I was in college, I was studying accounting, getting an accounting degree. And my dad said in very clear terms to me, whatever you do, son, don't become a banker. And so that
this
really
is your act of rebellion. What you chose is the act of rebellion. Good for you.
That's right. Exactly. So that's how I became a banker. It was interesting because my dad died when I was 30, so a long time ago. And when I went to the funeral, I was just amazed. Now, here's a little $60 million bank, and there were 400 plus people at my dad's funeral. And I'm like, who are all these people? And then people were getting up, you know, with effusive praise for my dad. And it was like there was a man there that I didn't even know out in the community that made a big impact to a lot of people. So actually, yes, it was an act of rebellion, but there's a better part to the story. I was inspired by him.
Well, knowing that your dad was a banker, you know, I always had this image that you as the sixth grader were drawing pictures. Other kids were going to be a cowboy or a fireman. And there was Kurt drawing, I'm going to be a banker. That theme about your dad and what he did and the role they play, you know, being so important to him, that man you really didn't know. You know, you say you're passionate about it. Would you say you love being a banker?
Yes,
why?
So it's interesting because I think some of that evolved, right? I mean, early in my career in the early 80s, there was a lot of rebellion. There was a, you know, I'm going to show you, Dad, I'm going to be a bit better banker than you ever were. And, you know, so there was a lot of that. And I went to work for what at the time was one of the largest banks in the country in Dallas. And, you know, so there was very much a kind of a, I wanted to adhere to what the bank was all about, follow the rules, be a model employee, do all those things, you know, be a captain of high finance. And there was something that happened to the very first kind of economic crisis in the mid late 80s that I experienced in watching people on the other end of the banking relationship suffer. And, you know, that wasn't something I think I was prepared for. And so I watched a lot of different behaviors. I watched people who were scoundrels and went to prison, and I watched people who sacrificed everything for their business and their employees and their families to make things right. And, you know, there's maybe somewhat of an inflection point there that I realized that, you know, there was an opportunity to actually support those people that were doing the right things. And banks were critical to the economy. And, you know, had banks not been able to stand up and support people during that, then they wouldn't have survived. And if every line we took was a hard line, then you're taking away the opportunity for the best people to shine. So it wasn't that clear to me at the and that's points of time. It just seemed like a lot of struggle during that period. But as time went on, that's the kind of thing that sunk into me. And I watched more and more entrepreneurs and fascinated to watch success. Success comes in all kinds of shapes and sizes, right? There's no formula. There's quiet people, there's boisterous, you know, all kinds of entrepreneurs. But there's kind of some tenets, you know, of doing the right thing that always sticks there. And you can kind of figure that out.
Yeah. Interesting you bring up the entrepreneurs, because if someone were to meet you on the street, you know, there's some bankers you can see from across the room. There's like, you are clearly a banker. Your shoes are very shiny. You look like you sleep in khaki pants and a polo. But to see you across the room, I think most people would guess you are actually, you know, some kind of technologist, you know, skinny jeans, cool shirt, you know, the close cropped beard, cool glasses, you know, and I guess, it's true why you love being a banker. You are very much a tech geek. And, you know, CAB is very tech driven, given that you have national reach, but a single branch that you don't even take deposits in. And you talk to fintechs all the time. Like, it's very rare, I think, that you and I have a conversation that you're like, don't at least bring up one fintech that I haven't even heard of yet, which always amazes me. Do you think there's a difference in the source of passion between banks and fintechs?
Ah, that's an interesting question. First, thanks for that very high compliment, I guess. I think there is, but not in broad-based, right? I think in some ways, let's be honest, there's a group of bankers who like the prestige that comes with a position and being able to be a pillar of the community and hang out in the nicest country club around. There's certainly some segment of that, and there's also the big, you know, the Wall Street banks and the images that they have in the community. So there's part of the industry that's stuck, but there's also this enormous amount of the banking industry that is very passionate about the new ways that are the new opportunities in front of us. And I think on the fintech side, there's a similar split. It's just different. There are a number of fintechs that are out there looking for the quick payoff and the quick buck, right? Let me build something fast. Let me scale something fast and flip it. But then there's this whole other segment of fintech that's looking out for, you know, what can we build that's durable and long lasting and it's going to impact the way we do things, not just now, but for the future, forever, you know? And I think when you go to these massive kind of fintech conferences and such, it's really interesting because you can kind of, have you been to enough? And you have, certainly, Jason. You get to start to be able to segment in both sides, you know, who are opportunists that are looking for the quick dollar and who are the ones that are really passionate about fundamental change in how we do things, you know, where is that magic kind of sauce, right?
When you're partnering with fintechs, how do you test for that? Because I know you've told me before that alignment of values is really important when you're partnering with a fintech. And I'm curious if that's different when it's you acting as a bank for them versus if you're looking at using them internally. But this idea of values, how do you test that kind of alignment?
So it's interesting. I don't know if there's a clear formula. I mean, we do everything from fintechs as just vendors, right? All the way to sponsoring and partnering deeply with some fintechs. And the closer we get to the partnership, we do in some of the very early conversations, if not the very first conversation, it's, you know, we ask their executives to tell us, what is your mission statement? What are your values? And, you know, what are you trying to accomplish for the customer? Tell us about it, you know, open-ended. And then we just kind of continue that conversation. And ultimately, there's a point where a founder is going to reveal really what's going on. We give them enough time to talk about their business, and you're going to kind of get a sense of what they're in it for. And it's tough because sometimes the ones that are passionate about doing the right thing are these really impactful kind of consumer-driven, you know, banking the underbanked or unbanked and things of that nature, have the riskiest business models. And, you know, in your heart, you really want to reach out and you want to do that with them, even though the chances of success might be really minimal. And that's hard because as a bank, you have a fiduciary responsibility. So somewhere in that mix, you've got to make your best guess and take a risk, right? We're risk takers. And so we try to be organized and disciplined about it, but action-oriented too.
As you've been building these tech partnerships and you're implementing more technology, does that change how you start to think about your customers and along which dimensions?
Yeah, I think it does change because I think if you sit there long enough, you know, certainly there's innovation all around us right now happening. And you can almost like going down a buffet line, right? You can pick and choose a bunch of different things and cobble them together and have something very cool. But fundamentally, and, you know, through a fire process or something similar to that, you start to get into jobs to be done and you start thinking about what's the simplest, cheapest, most efficient way to help a customer solve that job that they need done, right? And when you get into that realm and you're thinking about completely different ways to align processes or resources or functionality, you know, that's where you're thinking you have the potential to hit gold. Everything's a hypothesis, though, until it's tested, right? You taught me that.
Well, I mean, you guys have done a phenomenal job at embracing the idea of test and learn. As you brought more tech and more test and learn into the business, have there been any pitfalls?
A lot, right? And it's reading a lot of interesting things in the last few weeks about the concept of failing fast and, you know, failure's not an option or is an option, right? And you've been in this dialogue and it's, how do you get a culture change around, especially in banking, around making mistakes, and mistakes are okay, but maybe failure's not okay. Maybe we need to get rid of that term, fail fast, because we want to keep on a path to success. Nothing inspires your teams more than winning, right? So if you have a long goal that's hard for them to visualize, but you kind of give them some pathways towards that goal and they can, you know, win or stumble and get back up and win quickly after that, that's where you keep the engagement and excitement going. And so one of the biggest pitfalls, I think, is you have to say no, or you have to let go of things that people put a lot of effort into. We recently have two good examples, but they end up with very positive outcomes. One was a partner we worked for a year on that partnership. And then in the end, there was a culture and values problem that came up. And after a year of work, we terminated that one. And it was tough for the team. It was the team that stood up and pointed it out to us. And so, you know, at that level, we think we were doing some things right because they raised their hand and said, we're kind of concerned about this. And we decided not to go for it. So, right, a lot of resource, and I don't consider that a failure. I think that's a valuable pivot. And we just recently had another one, you know, working on 15 months on another major potential partnership. And this one kind of got sideways simply because what's going on in the economy right now kind of made the economics change on us. So there's no fault of either party. And, you know, those are tough things. So you're asking people to step up and work extremely hard, put a lot of resources and a lot of their own passion and sweat equity into things. And you're having to say no and pivot away from things. And if you don't have the right culture and you're not able to kind of move on to the next quick win, if you're not constantly have the queue filling up with opportunity, I think that could be pretty devastating. So, yeah, it's been tough.
The cultural ramifications of idea and tech, you know, comes up, you know, quietly as a theme, but repeatedly, that I think it's often overlooked. This point you just made around, you know, you don't want to demotivate people by saying no, but by the same token, sometimes the greatest risk is actually continuing to act as if nothing is wrong and, you know, just continue to make forward progress and hope it's going to be okay in the end. Given the current, you know, world situation, maybe the most dangerous of all is just pretending, you know, it will all be okay without intervention. But how have you grown that as a culture? Are you learning some of this from the tech companies you work with? Because that value, it, you know, at least in the media, is much more espoused by the tech-driven company versus the, you know, traditional banker that values rightness and, you know, staid and systematic, but sound decision-making and doesn't waver. You know, those two don't always seem very compatible.
Right. No, that's a really good point. And one of the issues we have in the banking industry is a lot of the training we get over time causes us to have a mentality to reduce risk down to zero. And yep. If you think hard enough about that, that actually would be self-defeating, because if you take no risk as a bank, you can't make money. We make money by taking measured risk. And so, but it is a prevalent culture, and it's reinforced a lot by regulatory regimes and other things. And so it's very easy to find a comfortable place in that take no risk kind of culture. And so, yes, to part of your common question, we've learned a lot, and tying our culture in with some of the fintech partners we have has helped tremendously. And, you know, one example is we have one of our partnerships where we have teams working every day together on small business loans. And so there's a team on that end, somewhere around 10 people, and we've got about 7 or 8 in our team that work intricately together every day. And when we started some 15 months ago, you know, we only had one person in our shop, but as this grew, and the pace and the creativity and the kind of collaboration kind of infected a group within our bank with that kind of fintech energy. And, you know, we point to that and we try to take that little infection, the good infection, right? So that's the good bacteria that are in you, and spread it around and say, look how hard these guys work, but also look how much fun they're having every day. And look at the impact that we're having in our customers. And it takes time, but I think we've got a broader feeling that that's the positive that our employees hang on to and say, hey, I know how my piece of the puzzle, what I do every day, fits into the bigger picture of accomplishing this or helping out our customer. And that's all you need. And then it's just kind of happens like a Greek, I guess.
Curious how the people who are infected with the positive sense of that part of the culture was there any kind of organ rejection by the rest of the bank, you know, when they kind of came back? Did they, well, I guess everyone within Tab pretty much wears jeans and looks, you know, your bank actually looks like it could be a tech company when you pull up to it and how people interact. Yeah. But were there any kind of, you know, like corporate norms that kind of came out to squash that, like the, no, you're, you know, moving too fast and, you know, taking too much risk. We can't do that. We're a bank, you know, for the love of God, we're a bank. Don't forget we're a bank. Act like a bank.
Yeah, it's actually for us, we've evolved over 6 years, I guess. And so the bank, you know, even though we are a single location internet-based bank, and we have been for 21 years, you know, in the early days, we were doing things with fax machines and kiosks that were placed in travel centers, truck stops across the country. So it was very manual. And the bank went through some turmoil about 9 years ago, that was pretty devastating to the staff and the, you know, the owners at the time. So we'd come out of that when I joined the bank. But we had a very isolated culture, right? So we had silos, the typical silos that you find a lot of organizations over that have any age to them. These were pretty bad. I mean, it was literally, I finish our work and we're going to take a pile of papers and throw them over the cubicle wall to you guys, and it's not my problem anymore. And as those walls were broken down, literally, because we did at some point, we said we have to get rid of all these cubicle walls. As we did different interesting things with fintech partners, there's a point where if you're sitting at a playground, you know, being grumpy, playing with your toys by yourself, and you see a lot of kids in the jungle gym, you know, having a great time or riding on the swings, eventually you're going to be attracted to kind of roam over there and see what's going on. And that's kind of what happened with us. I mean, it took a few pockets of winning, of excitement and passion. And people actually started job hopping into those groups. You know, we very much encourage transfers within the bank. 30 to 40% of our staff transfer in a given year to a new role, you know, a new role in a different group. And because we encourage that, you know, people were starting to migrate to these more exciting areas. And eventually it spread. And we still have pockets of grumpy people hanging around.
I'm going to bite my tongue and say that it's like risk and compliance is, you know, the grumps, but...
I can't say that wholeheartedly, but there are some grumps, yes. But no, we've got a great compliance team. It's one of our things I'm most proud of, actually. So I can't say that, but I'll let you say it, and then maybe it applies to somebody else.
Well, closing, you know, comments. How important has it become through this cultural change over the last, you know, 8 years with what the bank's weathered, how you leverage technology, that you are in many ways have always been a fintech bank? It just happened that tech used to be kiosks and fax machines, but it was the only tech available at the time. How important has a cultural value around only hiring people who are passionate about, you know, being a banker been? Is that something you actually test for when bringing people onto the team?
Now, so the interesting thing is that, and even the Utah Bankers Association started a program 3 years ago, Proud to Be a Banker, and just kind of highlighted all the different roles within a bank that aren't what people visualized, right? So it's not a customer service rep in a branch, it's not a teller, et cetera, you know, because our bank doesn't have any of those. And, you know, so when we do our Proud to Be a Banker kind of highlights, it's always showing, you know, here's our data analysts and our business intelligence people, here's our programmers, here's the software we built, come look at this cool stuff. And even our compliance people who are critical in our strategic partnerships with our fintechs, we export that expertise and you know, we even promote that it's cool to be a compliance guy, because look at all the fun you have working with these fintechs and helping them master compliance. And, you know, we're not a very well-known bank, but we're attracting talent from a broad range of places these days. And it's really, that's the proof in the pudding, I think. People find kind of what we're doing interesting. And at our core, we are a bank, but we have challenging work every day. And it doesn't involve dealing with a line of customers in a teller window by any means.
or being forced to wear a suit, standing behind, you know, that glass of the teller window and not seeing the results, you know, of what you do, you know, culturally being close to Tab Bank. It's been very cool to see. You are very much, you know, more of a tech company in that regard than anything else in what you've done. So thanks for talking about your passion with the listeners at Breaking Banks. I think we're at a point in the world where everyone wants to hear some of the good things that are happening in the industry and the people that are helping drive that forward. Kurt Kirose is CEO of Tab Bank, based in Utah, although they serve national footprint in the U.S., and he's definitely a proud tech geek banker who loves what he does.
Thanks very much, Jason. Always great to talk.
That's it for this week. Thanks to our guests and to our sponsors who help make the show possible. You may have a little more time on your hands right now, so you can listen to all of our more than 300 shows, plus episodes from all of our other shows, including Breaking Banks Europe, Tech on Reg, the Finovate podcast, and more, all on Provoke.fm. I hope you like them, and if so, that you'll give all the shows 5 stars and share them with others. Stay home if you can, take care of your loved ones, and let's all work together to move this industry forward and to make it stronger than ever. That's it for this week. We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.